Supreme Court is going to begin hearing a case of such significance that you can't pay too little attention to it. The Michigan case, affirmative action case, could lead to a decision that would have an impact not just on all of you, but your sisters, your brothers, and your children in terms of what it's going to mean for institutions in this country and their practices towards the creation of diverse, openly accessible kinds of institutions. So nothing in my mind that's happening domestically is more important than the struggle to retain at least some vestige of a commitment to affirmative action. We're pleased and proud to have a speaker who's done some amazing work, up close and personal work, at Michigan, listening, learning, and talking to people who are deeply involved in that institution and in the struggle for affirmative action. Teresa Stern is a longtime friend of Frank Holmquist and his partner, and someone I've gotten to know, and others of you will get to know. And she's uniquely placed to talk to us about what the Michigan case means, what she's learned from her discussions, from her interviews, from the connections she's had with real-life people, students, faculty at Michigan, and what it's going to mean for next week. I also hope we did some mailbox stuffing with material from an organization that is closely linked to, the sort of acronym, not an acronym, the abbreviation for By Any Means Necessary.org, yielded some of the posters that we had put out. And they are doing some amazing work towards the organizational demonstrations next week and ongoing demonstrations on behalf of affirmative action policies. So, briefly, Teresa Stern.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming today. I think the time really is important because of the Supreme Court case coming up next Tuesday. There is going to be, we hope, a sizable demonstration that day in Washington, Civil Rights March on Washington, to show the Supreme Court justices that this is a really important issue. It's worth keeping in mind that basically Sandra Day O'Connor is the swing vote on this decision, and she admitted in the last really major controversial decision that she decided on, it was an abortion decision, that having a massive demonstration actually influenced her. She wrote that in her opinion, which is very unusual for Supreme Court justice. So we do know that a strong public voice could have an impact on the court's decision. So I encourage any of you who are interested to go. I know that there are buses going from this area. But anyway, let me get to the topic, which is really what this whole case is about. As Michael said, I'm researching this, I'm working on a book about it, and I've just published an article in the current Ms. magazine about this. If the case loses, and I'm going to give you some of the details on the case, one thing that is important to bear in mind is that it's going to affect every public and private institution in the United States. This is not just University of Michigan or just public universities. And a lot of private colleges have already started dismantling sensitive admissions programs they have. Even summer enrichment programs for urban high school kids they're taking apart. This has happened already at Yale, at Princeton, at several other schools, because they're afraid of lawsuits. And because they realize that they're afraid that the outcome is going to be against affirmative action and they're then going to have to give up their own programs. What the case basically consists of is two different cases that are combined by the Supreme Court. There are two, there's one case is against the undergraduate school, that's Jennifer Gratz and two or three other plaintiffs against the University of Michigan. Then a second suit is Grutter versus Bollinger, who was then president of the University of Michigan, and the Grutter case is against the law school. Each of these young women applied for admission in 19, 95, I believe is their legal life. The suits were filed in 97. Both of them are white women who apparently felt that they had an entitled spot, did not get accepted, and claimed that this was a case of reverse discrimination and that the admittance that they each expected they should have received instead went to a less qualified minority applicant. The organization that is behind this case, both cases, and has provided all of the legal power, muscle, and money, is an organization called the Center for Individual Rights, which is generally known as CIR. They're an ultra-conservative, right-wing organization that has been carrying on. Basically, their mission is to use the legal system to try to roll back programs that are supposed to equalize opportunity, not only for minorities, but also for women, for immigrants. And they have had many laws in the country. For instance, they sued the University of Minnesota because it gave lump sum settlements to some of the female faculty based on prior discrimination. They are also now defending an organization in Farmingville, Long Island, not an organization, but a community, which is trying to force all the Latino immigrants in the community to leave, claiming that they're illegal and that they shouldn't be there. So these are the kinds of cases that CIR is pursuing. And actually, it's quite interesting to go on their website, Center for Individual Rights. I think it's CIR. I can't remember exactly what it is, but if you look it up, it's easy to find. Because they, you know, they proudly will show all the different cases that they have filed, and you can see that they have a very consistent mission. They've also said, I know that many of you have probably heard, offered as an alternative to affirmative action, the 10% plan of Texas or the 20% plan of Florida, has already stated that that's its next frontier. It's planning to sue those states claiming that even those plans, which don't even work, are unconstitutional. I'd like to explain a little bit about how the University of Michigan admissions policies actually work so that you'll be familiar with the case. The undergrad school and the law school operate differently. The undergraduate school uses a point system, so, you know, clearly a numerical calculation. There's a total of 150 points that an applicant can get. They get 110, up to 110 for grades, test scores, and whatever kinds of curriculum that they took. Then other factors add up to the additional 40 points. Since they get 10 points if they're Michigan residents, they get 20 points if they're from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, they get 20 points for being an athlete, they get 20 points for being an underrepresented minority, or for being from a low-income family, and no one gets 20 points both for minority and low-income, so you get for one or the other. On the other hand, the law school does not use a point system. They just use a more subjective, they say that they look at the whole student and the whole class, and that they want to make sure that they have a good balance. That's really what they're looking for. And so they say, you know, they want to know about extracurricular activities, community service, what kinds of law someone's interested in. And among those many factors, they consider race and socioeconomic status. The percentage of minority enrollment at the University of Michigan Law School, which is actually quite low even today, has varied between, 7 and 18% or something like that over the last 10 years or so. Also, even if you're just going purely by the university's affirmative action policies, there's no reason to assume that either of these students would have been accepted anyway, because Jennifer Gratz, the one who's suing the undergraduate school, who claims that a less qualified minority applicant got in instead, well, in the year that she applied, over 1,400 non-minority students with scores and grades lower than hers were admitted to the Michigan, which shows you that they do consider a variety of factors. Similarly, Barbara Gruder, who sued the law school, the year that she applied, her LSAT scores were actually not very high. And among the white applicants who applied the same year that she did, only 9% with scores as low as hers got in. So again, there's no reason, she has no sound basis going purely by her scores to assume that she had been admitted. One important aspect of this case, which has gotten almost no media coverage, but I think it's really important, and is one of the reasons I wanted to write a book about this, is that there's a group that has been part of this case. Most people hear the plaintiff and the defendant, the plaintiff being the two women in the CIR, the defendant being the University of Michigan. But there's a third group, which are known legally as the interveners, the student interveners. There's a legal step that one can take if you feel that there's a case being taken to court and that you are a party with a completely different view, a different argument that you think has an important impact on the case, and you want to be able to present that to the court, you can file for a motion to intervene so that your voice can be heard. A group of 41 students, most from the law school but not all, some of them were high school students who, you know, hoped eventually to get into the law school. There were minorities, there were women, plus three organizations, which were pro-integration organizations, together filed a motion to intervene because they wanted to present an argument to the court. They wanted the students' voices to be heard, and they had a very different argument from the universities. The university's rationale for defending their affirmative action policy was primarily diversity. It was also largely that they did not want the government telling them who they could and couldn't admit. In a sense, it's sort of a privacy issue. You know, it's up to us who we want to let in. Much more, they never argued on the basis of equal opportunity. That has never been part of their argument. Diversity, the closest they came to that was the diversity argument, which is basically that they're saying that they feel it makes for a more fruitful, more democratic classroom to have a diversity of people and views. And that if we want to prepare people for life in the United States, which is a very diverse place, that we need to, you know, have a campus that reflects that. They never attached a number or a percentage to that. And one of the reasons the student interveners wanted to present a separate argument was because they believed that the university's argument could easily be satisfied by a very token number of minorities. You know, how many people does it take to make a classroom diverse? Is it two? Is it three? Is it 10? You know, it was never clear. The student interveners had a very different point of view, which was much more based on a social justice point of view, feeling that the reason affirmative action is important is because essentially it's a desegregation program for higher education. That's really all it is. And that because of the fact that our K-12 school system is highly segregated, and right now it is more segregated than it was in 1970, that the fact is that most minority youth are not prepared as well as white youth are for college. And so the only way to give equal opportunity to college is by using affirmative action. And so a number of the interveners were people basically saying, I wouldn't be here in school today if it weren't for affirmative action. And some of them were high school students from Detroit saying, I want to have a future, I want to be able to go to law school or to the University of Michigan, a place that most Detroit city kids only dream about going to. And they felt it was important for the judge to hear their views. Interestingly, they assembled an amazing panel of expert witnesses who flew in to present arguments to the court. University of Michigan did not use a single expert witness. They brought John Pope Franklin, who's really known as the father of African American studies and wrote the first textbook that was used for that. He's now in his upper 80s and gave an amazing testimony. A lot of it personal. And just note that you can read the testimony. It's available online through the University of Michigan's website, and some of it is really fascinating. And he talked about being a researcher as a graduate student in the South and the difficulties he went through trying to he arrived, I believe it was at Duke, and he arrived there, and they told him, we're so sorry to know that you were colored, and if we had known, we would have had a special desk set up for you, a special room. And so they decided that the only way to accommodate him was to give him a key to the stacks so that he wouldn't have to sit in the research room with the white graduate students. And so he worked very happily in the stacks. He said it was like, you know, free shopping. He could get all the books he wanted. He was having a grand time. And then, of course, within a week, the white students were complaining because he had access to the stacks. And they didn't switch it. They took his key away. And they put him in the room and they gave the white students access to the stacks. And he talked a lot about how growing up in the South and going through his education, how arbitrary the rules of the Jim Crow rules were, essentially. That, you know, at one restaurant, you weren't allowed in, you had to stay in your car and they would serve you outside. But at the restaurant right across the street, you weren't allowed to, you had to go in, because if you were served outside, it made it look as if the white waitresses were, you know, into you. And he said there were never signs telling you what the rules were. And, you know, he talked about the humiliation of that and what it was like. And and just recently, just a few years ago, I believe it was under Clinton, he was offered a presidential, some kind of president's commission award for his, you know, life as a scholar. And he went to Washington. He was maybe, you know, 82 or something like that. And he was dressed in his suit to go to receive his award. And he was waiting in the hotel and somebody gave him his car keys so he could go park the car. And, you know, so this is, he spoke very eloquently about the kinds of things that he's experienced. And Gary Orfield, who is the co-director of the Harvard Civil Rights Project, came and presented. Eric Foner from Columbia University, Walter Allen, the sociologist. They had quite an interesting array. They also had the director of the Princeton Foundation, which is related to the SATs, come to talk about bias and testing. And in fact, the judge actually thanked the intervener, saying that he had received a Harvard education through this trial, because so much interesting information came across. So that's a little bit about the interveners. And one of the really most powerful aspects was that they put three students on the stand to give testimony about their own experience. And I want to read you a couple of those, some pieces from their own. I think they're quite interesting. One of the students was a young woman named Erica Dowdell, who at the time of when she testified was a student at the University of Michigan. She's now a first-year law student at UCLA Law School. But she had become involved in defending affirmative action while she was still a high school student at Cass Tech, which is considered the cream of the crop of Detroit's public schools. It's very much oriented to assuming that kids will go to college, although very few of them go to the University of Michigan, but it's definitely a college prep high school. So this is Erica in her own words. Cass, one of Detroit's top schools, was run down. Didn't have enough textbooks and never supplied toilet paper in the bathrooms. Still, I felt lucky to be there. But I started to see things differently in my senior year when I traveled with my school band to a state-level music competition at a high school called Livonia Churchill, about 20 miles away in the Detroit suburbs. I'd always known there was something strange about not having a French book, having no teacher for an AP government class, or never being able to use the outdoor playing fields because they were so poorly maintained. My music teacher had given me the one high-quality clarinet that Cass owned. The other instruments were held together with tape and rubber bands. But I hadn't realized it could be completely different somewhere else. When I saw Livonia Churchill, I was shocked and hurt. They had real sports facilities, a football stadium, and a soccer field. The students had top-of-the-line instruments with marble mouthpieces, all the nice things that make instruments sound better. And the judges were scoring us on intonation. Our group had started out very confident, but once we got there, our confidence turned into extreme embarrassment. So that was her first testimony about, basically, her revelation about the disadvantage she had by going to an urban school. And when asked about affirmative action during the testimony, the lawyer who was across examining her asked her whether she felt that she had experienced stigma as a result of being a student who had been accepted to the University of Michigan through affirmative action, since that's an argument that's so frequently used. And in answer, Erica said, "I have never been treated in a racist way because of affirmative action. Affirmative action has no stigma attached to it. Long before affirmative action was ever invented, the stigma came with being black. I feel stigmatized by people's racist views of me, by their making assumptions about me that have nothing to do with who I am as a person." And then recently, I interviewed Erica recently. I was at a civil rights summit that she attended, and I was asking her what impact she thought the student interveners had on the court. And just to give you a little bit of background, what happened in the case with the law school case, that they gave very powerful testimony The judge said he was totally convinced that that minority students suffer discrimination and that we do in fact live in a segregated society, but he decided against them because he said that he couldn't find a remedy within the law. So actually that was what made Erica decide to become a lawyer when she heard that. So they went on to the Federal Appeals Court, the Sixth Circuit Court in Cincinnati, later that same year. This was in one, the district level was in February and the Federal Appeals Court was in December in Cincinnati. So this is Erica reflecting on that. When I testified, it was overwhelming for me that so many students from Detroit, Ann Arbor, and other surrounding high schools had come out to give testimony and be involved in the case. Not only because they were invited to hear someone tell their story, but because this was their story too. They realized that they had a stake in this case. When I was on the witness stand, there were people sitting there and saying, "Yeah, too." It was like everyone in the courtroom was involved. And the judge could see that this was everyone's experience. That made a big difference in the court proceedings. And it made an impression on the judge. Even though he ruled against us, he still had to say, yes, segregation does still exist. Yes, discrimination still exists in this society. I think it made a very big difference that we went to Cincinnati to the Court of Appeals and packed that courtroom. It was pouring down rain. We were all soaking wet. About 3,000 of us marched for 2 miles. We still went in the freezing cold courtroom to hear those proceedings. Just to let those justices know, this is not something that could be calculated as just numbers and percentage plans. This is affecting a lot of people's lives. Actually, at the Cincinnati courthouse, they had so many people turn out to hear it that for the first time in the court's history, they had to open up a large hall with an audio feed to accommodate all the people who wanted to hear the case because there were busloads of mostly high school students to hear it. And the Detroit courtroom was packed every day, high school students. I actually have copies of letters that they wrote to the judge, which are really amazing. And over again, they asked the judge to come to their school, just saying, you know, I don't want to tell you what it's like, I want you to come. A couple of them offered to take him out to lunch at McDonald's. And they just said, we want you to see what it's like. We go to, you know, especially the kids from the top prep schools, and many of those kids came from, you know, some of the poorer Detroit schools, really atrocious, but a lot of the kids from the three top prep schools in Detroit, the public schools, wrote very strong letters. So why is affirmative action still necessary? We're 50 years from Brown v. Board of Education. Next year is going to be the 50th anniversary. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of media talk about it. But we're actually more segregated now than we were in 1970. So how does this happen? Well, there's several questions. One is that when the Brown decision was made in 1954, the court really never clearly defined what compliance would look like. What do you have to do to be integrated? And is this a short-term remedy? Do you have to bus people for 5 years and then you can stop once you've proven that you're integrated? Which happened all over the place. They achieved levels that the courts found acceptable. So then the court said, okay, you don't have to do it anymore. So most desegregation programs were dismantled. But the strongest desegregation programs took place in the South. In the North, where residential segregation is so powerful, the cities are all minority, and outside the cities tend to be all white, there was never any desegregation. And one of the important reasons for that is actually a court case that was decided in 1974 in Detroit. It was the Milliken case, in which basically they had such a segregated school system, and there were virtually no people living in Detroit proper. So the only way to integrate the schools would have been to go outside the city, to go from suburb to city in both directions. And that case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, no, this cannot be required. So therefore, northern cities were never integrated in terms of their schools. Also, the Brown decision never set a timeline. They used very vague language. I can't remember the exact wording, but it was something like, you know, in due time or something like that. All deliberate speed, yes, thank you. So it didn't specify. And although there were several subsequent decisions, there was something called Brown 2, which was supposed to clarify some of those questions, there was a lot of vagueness, and it was very easy for districts to deny and never be held responsible. And Also, residential segregation has increased in the last 30 years. So right now, out of, I believe it's the 26 major urban centers in the United States, Salt Lake City is the only one which is not predominantly minority. So therefore, urban really equals minority. So if you go to school in the city, you're going to school in a segregated place. People sometimes say, well, you know, affirmative action is unfair to low-income whites. What about them? Because they go to, you know, they're likely to be going to schools which aren't well-funded, and they also lack, their parents may not be educated, they have a lot of the same obstacles that low-income minorities have. Well, there are several answers to that. And one is that statistically, and Gary Orfield at the Harvard Civil Rights Project, and has done a lot of really useful research about this. And by the way, you can download almost all their reports from their website, and they're full of information. But they have found that low-income whites are much more likely to both live in a neighborhood and attend school in a place which is socioeconomically diverse. So they're not segregated in an all-poor white ghetto. They tend to have some middle-class kids, some upper-middle-class kids. So they do get, they tend to go to schools which are better funded, have better resources, smaller classes, all of those things that make education superior. And they're also more likely to have networks in their, you know, general arena, which are gonna give them opportunities. Also, and I'm gonna talk in a few minutes about how affirmative action has actually helped working class people of all colors, which is a fact. Another question that people have about affirmative action is, what's wrong with the SATs? Since almost all schools use SATs or ACTs, that's objective, why not just go by those scores? Well, it's been proven over and over again that the standardized tests contain racial bias. And even the SAT authorities themselves say that it's clear. I mean, there's no dispute about it anymore. It's not entirely clear why they haven't. I think there are still some questions about what's causing the skew, and it's minorities. Women score about 40 points lower on average on the SATs than men, and clearly this is not tightly correlated with their performance because they tend to, women have better grades both in high school and college, and so the only thing that the SAT claims to do is be a predictor of first-year college grades, and clearly it doesn't even do that. It also doesn't predict, it's not a good predictor of ultimate outcome of career. There was a study at the University of Michigan, it was a long-term study of law school graduates, where they compared the LSAT scores of the students, you know, before they came in, and then how they did in their law career afterwards. And even though the minorities had across the board lower LSAT scores, they fared, their career success was completely on par with their white counterparts, so it was not a predictor of career performance either. And what I think is probably the best illustration of this skew is a very interesting study that was done at Berkeley, the Bolt Law School at University of California, Berkeley. There's a guy named Bill Kidder, who's an attorney and a law researcher, who has conducted a lot of studies on this subject, and he did one where he took the 15 top feeder schools to the Bolt Law School, which are mostly the schools, and he matched students going to Bolt from these feeder schools, but he matched them by their GPA and by their graduation dates. So in other words, these are like Yale, Harvard, University of Chicago, students from all those schools, put them in groups by their graduation date and the same GPA. And within those groups, African Americans scored 9.2 points lower than whites, even though they had the same GPA. Latinos scored almost 7 points lower than whites. And since the LSAT score only ranges between 120 and 180, that 9-point gap is definitely enough to determine whether or not you're going to get a spot in a law school. So the only thing I want to say about the tests, which I think really is telling, is that some research has been done recently where they were trying to determine what causes this racial skew or demographic skew. And what they did was they took people of mixed demographics and gave them a section of the SAT to take with the instructions that this test determines your abilities. When they gave it to them with that introduction, they completely replicated the racial skew and also the gender skew. When they gave them another section of the SAT and said, this is a different test, this test does not test your ability, it tests your ability to take a test. It completely erased the racial skew. Same information, different results. So that suggests to me that there's a psychological factor, you know, where minority students are assuming, have a lower expectations of their success, perhaps. I don't know, you draw your own conclusions. That's very interesting, and that test has been duplicated with a lot of different demographic groups, with African Americans, Latinos, women, Native Americans. So, clearly there's something happening there. So, in the places where affirmative action has already been dismantled, California is one of the best places to look at, what has happened? The ban was actually began its implementation in 1998 in California. It was voted in earlier, but that was the first year that it went into effect. Minority enrollment has dropped dramatically at the state's flagship campuses. Now, you'll hear that a lot of the, you know, what has been coming out in the papers and from California, that in fact minority enrollment is beginning to rise again in California. The fact is, there's now what they're calling a cascading effect, where it's true minority enrollment has begun to pick up at the undergraduate level, but not at the flagship campuses, not at Berkeley and UCLA, the most prestigious campuses that offer the greatest resources and facilities. They're going up at Riverside. They're going up at the smaller campuses, which are much less well-funded, which have much fewer resources. And so basically, they're saying over an average is picking up. But that doesn't really tell the whole story. The number of African-American freshmen admitted to Berkeley went from 515 in 1997, which was the last year before affirmative action was banned, to 290 in 2002. That's a big drop. At Bolt Law School, African-Americans accounted for an average of 23% of the enrollment in the 4 years preceding the ban. In the 5 years since the ban, average black enrollment dropped to 7%. Latino enrollment at Bolt dropped by half before affirmative action was banned. 4 years prior to the ban, Latinos comprised 13.2% of the students. After the ban, 6.4%. At UCLA Law School, the first year the ban was implemented, there were only 2 African-American students in the entire class of 300, the entering class. The newest class, which the one that Erica Dowdell is in, that just entered in 2002, out of 309 students, has only been black law students. So clearly, affirmative action does make a huge difference in equalizing educational opportunity. I have a quote from Pedro Noguera, who teaches education at Harvard, recently said at a summit that I attended. He said, "Of course, we'd all prefer to live in a race-neutral world. But if we want race not to matter in admissions, let it not matter in housing, health, education, employment, or criminal justice." I want to address the question of how working class whites and women benefit from affirmative action. Interestingly, it's not minorities who have gained the greatest benefit. It's been women. Affirmative action, by the way, was started, I think some people think it was some kind of a radical plan, but it was actually started by Johnson in 1965. Mm-hmm. As a reaction to the urban rioting and civil unrest that was going on. Clearly, he had to do something, and so they came up with this idea. Women, clearly white middle-class women, have been the greatest beneficiaries, women just like the two women who were suing University of Michigan. And I'm just going to give you a few examples. In 1971, women received 6.3% of all professional degrees. 10 years later, the figure had more than quadrupled to 27.5%. Between 1970 and 1998, the number of women increased from 5 to 29% of all lawyers, and from 10 to 27% of all lawyers. And these are figures from the U.S. Department of Labor. By 1998, the U.S. Department of Labor counted 5 times as many female engineers and 4 times as many female architects as in 1970. So women have made enormous jumps because of affirmative action. Also, it was through the beginning steps of affirmative action in the mid-60s that a lot of federal money started flowing in for education, which white students have had the exact same access to as minorities. For instance, the Pell Grant, which we now, you know, which everyone has been hearing about for years, that's when that was created. And universities used to be very elite, really just, you know, outposts for very wealthy people. But since the 60s and 70s, far more middle and working class people have been able to attend universities, and that's because of federal money. And that includes, certainly, white working class people. So the fact is that, and also, of course, as I mentioned about Michigan, most colleges and universities do consider socioeconomic status and all the obstacles that go with that in their admissions, not just race, which of course also benefits working class white people. So in fact, all people of low income have been beneficiaries. That sort of brings up the question, which some people have raised, why have affirmative action, why should it be race sensitive rather than just based on socioeconomic status? Why do you have to make a distinction? And the way I would answer that is that although they are connected, race and socioeconomic status, they are distinct. And poor whites, though they clearly lack opportunities of wealthier whites, do not also contend with a lifelong experience of racism. And that's an additional weight that a person carries and contends with every day of their life. For instance, the SAT scores are not skewed by socioeconomic factors. Poor and middle class and upper class whites, there's no disparity in their SAT scores. So there has to be some explanation for that. also, it may be related to what I mentioned earlier, which is that working class and poor whites are much more likely to school and live in communities that are more mixed socioeconomically, and they gain certain advantages from that. I'd like to address what happens, or what has been happening, where minority enrollment has dropped. What have the consequences been for the few minority students who are enrolled in those situations? I have a really interesting piece of testimony from one of those students, but it's commonly many of these students who find themselves very dramatically underrepresented minority feel that they're in a very hostile environment. In which racism may be communicated in subtle ways or in flagrant ways, but where they definitely feel it. Some people have spoken about feeling isolated, feeling invisible, and of course there's also been over-racial harassment in a number of places. A number of students have told me that they've had the experience where, like, if they're one of two or three in their class, or sometimes the only one in their class is a person of color, where they're expected to be kind of a spokesperson for their race. You know, where people say, well, what do blacks think about that? You know, and they're expected to know, you know, or somehow be able to speak for everyone. Another really dramatic consequence is that hate crimes rise, which might be surprising, and perhaps the reason is that as integration slides backward and is taken away, it may just be a greater license to bigots. But an incident that happened quite recently is at Berkeley this past Christmas morning. A woman named Felicia Maori, she was the resident head of the African American residential house there. She woke up in the morning and found white power graffiti and swastikas scrawled on the front of her dorm door, and found that they were also painted on the building that housed the Ethnic Studies Department at Berkeley. About 20 miles away at the University of California in San Francisco State University, I'm sorry, the white power symbol, the Celtic symbol, was scrawled there in feces. I interviewed several students who attend University of Tennessee at Knoxville who described what would be some kind of an art installation which consisted of nooses being hung all over the campus. And, you know, Confederate flags hung on a lot of dormitory doors. So I think people feel freer, bigots feel freer to express themselves when number of minorities drops, and I guess that leads to a feeling of empowerment, I mean, that's one conclusion we could draw. I want to read you a little bit from the testimony of a woman named Crystal James, who she was one of the people who testified in the University of Michigan case, for that she was a student intervener. And she was one of the students who went to UCLA Law School just after affirmative action was banned. And these are her words. On my first day at UCLA Law School in 1999, I looked around and found only one other face that looked like mine. Out of approximately 300 students, I could find only one African American. I was shocked. If I'd known, I never would. I've been a straight A honor roll student all my life. I majored in public policy at Stanford University and graduated with honors. Stanford had an affirmative action policy for admissions, and about 10% of their student body was African American. But I never felt that Stanford students, faculty, or administrators thought that I was there just because of affirmative action. In my first semester civil procedure class, the students sitting behind me would snicker whenever a woman or person of color would make a comment or answer a question. They'd say things like, "Oh, smart, look at her." This was our Socratic method class, so everyone was very nervous about speaking. Having these people sitting behind me made it that much harder to speak. I just want to add, she was 34 when she entered law school. Crystal was not a youthful student, so she was an adult. She had run a business, so she had kind of a bit of life behind her. I was pretty confident starting out. I'd raise my hand if I thought I knew something. I wasn't that embarrassed to be wrong. I'd been wrong before in my life. But I wasn't going to risk being laughed at, so I stopped raising my hand. I started to see a pattern emerging where it seemed I was kind of invisible. My torts professor assigned a student to be on a call each day for the assigned reading, but I was the only student in a class of 35 who was never asked to be on call. In my civil procedure class, initially I raised my hand. If I was called on, I'd be asked about the facts. But if we pursued any type of analogy or reasoning at all, if I wasn't right there with the professor, he would ask another student to explain what I was saying. With white students, if they didn't answer satisfactorily, they were afforded the opportunity to explain or clarify their original answer. Another teacher called on people by going up and down the rows rather than choosing people randomly. She would go down my row, but when she came to me, she would just skip over me and go to the next person. I don't know whether she wasn't calling on me because she didn't want to embarrass me or whether she knew that her not calling on me was embarrassing. It seems she wasn't calling on me because she believed I couldn't possibly know the answer. That was a stigma. That was embarrassing. When we got to Brown, meaning a discussion of Brown v. Board of Education, one of my classmates said that the Brown decision was wrong and should never have happened. I doubt if he realized that without that decision, I wouldn't have been sitting in that classroom with him. It was amazing to me that he could callously throw out a comment that in effect meant my being excluded from that classroom. It just didn't dawn on him what the significance of his comment really was. And that really upset me. What happened? I'm sitting there, my heart starts beating, I feel this pressure, I feel like I need to respond. But the blood starts going, my heart starts pumping. I don't want to respond from an emotional point because already I'm perceived as not being able to be rational as coming from an emotional perspective. I feel this burden of I need to react. But if I sound emotional, they're not going to listen to what I'm saying. So I don't say anything. I leave the classroom feeling such shame and guilt from not addressing those comments. When I told my professor about how I was feeling, he told me that other students had come to him complaining that they couldn't be candid in class because Lena and I were there. I was stunned. How much more candid do they want to be? They're already saying things that are, to me, very racist. In my criminal law class, we studied the Bernard Goetz case. We discussed a hypothetical case where a white woman is at an ATM withdrawing money when a black man approaches her to ask directions. She turns around and shoots him to death. The question was, is this legal? Is she experiencing extreme emotional distress? Someone answers yes, and we don't really discuss it. For me, it evoked the imagery of the Deep South, where a white woman could just claim anything and a black man would get lynched without even a trial. Then we move on to a new subject the next day. I felt as though I had lost a piece of myself. I lost my power. Each time I didn't raise my hand when I knew the answer, each time I didn't respond to a comment that I knew was wrong, I felt a little piece of me leaving. I felt a little bit of dying off. I think I was a tremendous person before I started law school. I had been through a lot. I had accomplished a lot. And in less than a year, I felt like this defeated person who had no power, no voice. That's how it is being one of two black students at UCLA Law School. In 1996, there were 80 black students at UCLA Law School, 80. In the entire law school now, by 2001, we had less than 10. That's what the end of affirmative action means. I'm much more conscious of race than before. In college, at jobs where I was the sole minority, I was always able to be Crystal James. Yes, I was always black woman Crystal James, but people saw me for my performance, for what I did. At UCLA, I am always, first of all, one of two black students, before people even know my name. I never get away from that. I don't get to be an individual. So I think that tells a lot of what it's like to be in such a tiny minority. And so that's one of the reasons why the diversity argument doesn't really work, because it's not just about, you know, having two or three students. It's about having enough people, having a real integrated situation where there's not a great imbalance of power. I just want to address for a couple of minutes some of the questions about the percentage plan, since those are being hailed as an alternative to affirmative action. Superficially, percentage plans appear to reward merit while being race neutral. Texas, the way their plan works is they guarantee the top 10% of every high school class admission to the University of Texas, which is a totally segregated state. So the percentage plan is predicated upon the high schools being segregated, because the only way it works to get equal, you know, to get a representative number of minority students is that they know that for black schools they're going to get 10% of those students. Another point about the percentage plan is that it has absolutely no impact on graduate or professional schools. It only deals with undergraduate. And in fact, in 1997, after this plan went into effect, only four black students enrolled at the University of Texas Law School out of a class of 400. Except for Asians, all minority enrollment has dropped since the percentage plan went into effect, even though supposedly it guarantees a certain minimum number. And there's also, again, that flagship issue. Different campuses, some campuses are better than others, and the minorities are tending to go to the less well-funded campuses. Plus, a percentage plan is completely irrelevant to most states that either don't have an enormous university system that can accommodate 10% of their high school graduates, and also it doesn't touch private schools at all. So there are many reasons why the percentage plan is not a viable alternative to affirmative action. So what can you do if you're so inclined? What are people doing to defend affirmative action? There has been a growing new civil rights movement building in this country, basically since 1995, when California voted Proposition 209 to ban affirmative action. It's active. I mean, the organization BAM, By Any Means Necessary, which Michael mentioned, is a leading organization, but it's not the only one. And in fact, if you go on their website and look at the colleges that are sending buses to the Civil Rights March next Tuesday, you can see that there are active civil rights groups at many college campuses all over, and also many high schools now all over the country. BAM itself is particularly active in several regions, in the Bay Area, in LA, in Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Cincinnati, and now in Washington, D.C., and they're beginning in New York. What they have been doing is really focusing on the defense of affirmative action and getting a lot of high school students involved. And I think there are some really interesting things happening in this new movement, which is quite different from the old civil rights movement. For one thing, it's committed to equal rights for everyone. It's not only, it's deeply exists, but not exclusively. It's also a stance for equal rights for women, for gays, for transgender people. It's a very much, it's actually very diverse. It's a very integrated movement, about 60% black and 40% white. And I think the 40% probably includes whites and other minorities. The majority of the leadership is female, which is quite interesting and very different from the last civil rights movement. And I think, and also many, it's definitely youth are at the forefront. And many of the both high school and college students who I've spoken with and heard, I've heard hundreds of them speak at civil rights conferences in the last year, are totally disenchanted with what they consider, sort of yesterday's tired leaders and, groups like NAACP and Rainbow Push, they just feel are very irrelevant, are not listening to their concerns, and haven't, in fact, taken a very strong stand in or much initiative to defend affirmative action. What they're saying is that regardless of what the Supreme Court decides next Tuesday, the decision, by the way, won't be announced until probably June. They only get an hour in court. I was shocked when I heard that, such a complicated issue. And of course, all the everything is submitted, you know, in documents months in advance. And what I'm told, the general MO is that they spend about a week talking about it, come to sort of agreement, but they don't actually make a formal opinion and announce it until June. But what the BAM leadership is saying is that regardless of which way it goes, they're going to continue to fight. That the next, if they lose, what they want to focus the next campaign on is going to be eliminating the use of the SAT as a criteria in college admission, and also fighting for desegregating K-12 schools. Basically, all they're really asking for is to fulfill the promise of Brown. That's what they're working, never been fulfilled, and they're still working for that. So that's what I have to say, and I welcome any questions. Well, I don't think it can be proven that it's caused exclusively by affirmative action, but clearly affirmative action created legal pressure on institutions to include women as well as men, and so they found that they had to comply. So I think it was a major factor.
This is more of a comment. From my personal experience, I'm glad you kind of touched on the issues in the Northern and South, because one thing I did notice growing up in Northern Virginia is that even though, like, the city I lived in was next to D.C., Alexandria, very cream of the crop kind of place, basically had everything I think a well-funded place would have, and then moving to Baltimore and seeing a major transition to students not really having much, about 40 students in a class, and then going to high school at one of the cream of the crop high schools, just the difference totally, and then, like, in Baltimore itself, a lot of the people, majority of the whites, go on to county or in private schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing Maryland and Baltimore does a lot. And city schools are really run down and bad, but the private schools, creme de la creme, students go on to, you know, wherever. But my personal experience, I know, like, even my friends in New Jersey, was just that compared to me growing up in Virginia and seeing that type of diverse lifestyle, and then moving up north and seeing it gets a little more and more segregated, which is really weird compared to what you've read in the history books and what you're taught, that, you know, down here, you know, we'd be the ones that need to desegregate, but up here, you know, they still have this pocket of segregation, which I never thought would actually be possible or true.
Right. Did you go to City in Baltimore?
Yes, I did,
you
actually.
Did. I went to Western.
Oh, okay. My brother went to Poly.
Okay. Other questions?
Yeah, I actually found it interesting, the breakdown that you mentioned, or I should say the lack of differential in test scores when this different rationale is given. And I'm trying to reconcile that with this other piece of information that those of us who kind of work in this area know, which is that Asians generally tend not to do worse on the SATs.
That's true.
Than whites. And I'm wondering if you might offer some comments on that, especially in light of what your speculation that there's a psychological factor that's at play when we look at differentials and test scores across race, as well as your other your other comment about how there isn't as strong a differential among people of different classes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, actually, I'm glad you brought up the issue of Asian students, because that's something which is raised a lot. And I want to point out that it's important to differentiate between different subgroups of Asians, because basically, due to the U.S. immigration policy over the last 50 years, there are some Asian groups which are totally on par with whites, and which are considered overrepresented minorities. That's what they're called, at, you know, at colleges, being primarily Japanese, Korean, and an older wave of Chinese. Whereas Vietnamese and Cambodian and many South South Asian students and Filipinos tend to suffer very much the way minorities do in terms of their access to higher education. Asians who have been, whose families and have had more generations in this country, my guess is as good as yours as far as like what accounts for why they do as well as whites, but I'm assuming it's because, I would tend to guess, it's because they, the whole sort of model minority stereotype has definitely planted an assumption of high performance in academics. And I think Asians tend to go to schools more with whites, so therefore getting, K-12 are getting better early education. Assimilating, but also having a lot of the benefits that most minorities never see because they don't get into white schools. So, Asians, middle class and upper middle class Asians are much more likely to live next to whites than they are to live next to blacks. And so I think that they're basically getting kind of the trickle-down effect.
But that seems to still be at odds with your reference to how lower class whites don't seem to do noticeably worse.
But they also are more likely to go to school with whites of greater privilege. See, that they're less likely to be segregated than people of color.
Wouldn't they be more likely to work in working or to go to school in working class neighborhoods where the income base is much lower, the tax base is lower?
Working class whites, you mean? I think that's true, but at least from the reports I've read, they may live in a neighborhood which is working class, but there tends to be more mixture. There's more a greater likelihood that they would go to a school that has more middle class people attending. So I'm sure there are, neighborhoods where there are segregated poor white areas. I'm sure they must exist, but I think they're much fewer and far between than the same for minorities.
I was wondering if you could speak on the issue of the student interveners not being able to present at the court, please.
At the Supreme Court?
Yeah, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about why that decision came, what happened to cause that.
Okay. Student interveners were actually given a lot of information about exactly, the way it works was that they had to file a WIP. They had to submit their request with the court to present at each level, at the district level. And in fact, they were refused. Their motion to intervene at the initial district level was turned down. They appealed it and won an appeal. At the appellate level, at the appeals court, they then won, and so they were able to present there. Although the vast majority of their whole argument was put forward at the district level. That's where all the experts testified and everything. At the Supreme Court, once again, they had to submit a writ requesting to go before the Supreme Court. But in the end, this is what I was told, was that it was up to the University of Michigan whether or not they wanted to allow this other party to speak. Because they were, although they were a separate party, they were for the defense. They were defending affirmative action. And I don't know whether the university didn't want them because they felt they were a diversion from their own argument, or because they didn't want to give up 7 minutes of their 22. I don't know what their reason was. But the university has had no, there's been no love lost, I would say. The University of Michigan has shown very little support to the student interveners. For instance, just this past Martin Luther King Day, at the University of Michigan, that's when the interveners, and BAM hosted a civil rights summit, had people come from all over the country, and had a big march, which was very well attended. There were thousands of people, and Jesse Jackson actually spoke at the march, and the university didn't provide anything. They didn't even put it on their website. No mention of it anywhere, and basically kind of seemed to want to wash their hands of it. I think because the arguments were different, and I think they felt that the student interveners were to the left in terms of, they were actually asking for equal opportunity, which the college never suggested, which the university was not arguing. And I think they felt maybe that it muddied their argument, if possible. But they really haven't worked as allies. They've really been two separate parties.
Two quick things. In last week's Chronicle of Higher Education, there's a really solid article that looks at the demonstrates that they're much less successful, even than people thought who were critics. And that's worth looking at. It mentions some of the same kinds of things that you mentioned, but it also documents the significant fall off. There was a sort of early period where it looked like numbers were going to hold steady, but apparently it's just not the case. I'd commend that article to anybody who's interested in where the percent plans were. It was just last week. In terms of black achievement and the kinds of psychological effects on black achievement and black score, black scores versus white scores, there's a literature that's developed. Probably the best known person is Claude Steele, who's been writing a lot. There's another book.
He was an expert witness.
Yeah. There's another book that just came out that looks at black achievement and the differential in scores from the same vantage point by a woman named Teresa Perry who writes. And so there is a burgeoning literature that looks at that and tries to explain the differences between, say, black and Latino test takers and Asian test takers and addresses some of the questions that Tina raised. So.
Thank you.
Well, I think a lot of, you know, what you said is all the compelling evidence for the continuation of affirmative action, which I basically agree with. But the thing that you didn't discuss, and there's no reason you should have, but I want to ask you about is, despite all of that, what might be some of the negative aspects of continuing to have a race-conscious approach to remedy and legal action generally in terms of kind of the reification of categories of race and the difficulty of using categories of race in a society where, you know, we're more aware of the fictitiousness, if you will, of race as a category. And whether you're familiar at all or have any thoughts about some of the work that's being done, at least in the legal scholarly world, to develop a kind of approach that's neither the colorblind approach that's being used to strike down affirmative action, nor that's based on a sort of older model of race consciousness. Whether you have any thoughts about that?
Well, a number of people addressed that at the summit that I was just mentioning, and I think, you know, it was best summed up in that quote that I read of Pedro Nogueira, which is, you know, we'd all love to have race-neutral admissions, but when the rest of the world isn't race-neutral, we can't really do that. I actually would argue that there is not a negative side, that as long as we live in a racist society, affirmative action is needed, and that I don't see a negative side to it, really, because without it, we have segregated schools. That's the reality.
Well, I wasn't talking, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wasn't talking just about affirmative action. I was talking about, in a sense, that larger question of, are there downsides to a racially conscious, what's the word I'm wanting? Not specific remedy, if you will, of affirmative action or behavior of affirmative action, but to, you know, a lot of what the Supreme Court is saying is about the sort of their version of what the problem is with this larger language of race and the importance of color blindness. And so I'm trying to, I guess I was asking about that larger debate, not just the specific.
You mean that race is a social construct, you mentioned? Is that what you mean?
Yes, yeah, race-conscious legislation, Stephanie? Is that what you're suggesting? Well, is race,
just
race-conscious?
Yeah, in all
as
areas
the CRT,
of the law.
Yeah,
in all
school
areas of the law.
Yeah. You know, like as Gary Keller and Neil Gottemba will talk about in critical race theory, right? Just this idea that, you know, that color consciousness is in some sense a necessary way to address racism. Is it necessary? Is there some other, you know, can you define categories of color and race in legislation?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Stephanie.
No, thank you. I don't know if anyone else would like to address that. I don't really have a good answer to that. I'm familiar with some of those sort of theoretical debates going on, although not deeply. I mean, I've just kind of, in a superficial way, have followed them and done a little bit of reading about it. But I don't know. I guess basically, I'm thinking that based on the reality that most people live, this seems like something that needs to happen. And I don't know what could be offered as an alternative. But if anyone, do you want to say something?
Well, race is a social construction, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have real social effects in the way in which people gain access to employment, education, housing, etc. And the idea that it can be changed and challenged simply by a different discourse or different language, I think that's a really erroneous way to look at it. Because in fact, yes, it's a social construction, just like all sorts of class inequality, etc., are social constructions. They're the creations of human society. But that doesn't mean that they're the products, I think, of language or of how we think about the world. They're the products of the way we interact in the world. And until, in fact, race is no longer a real way in which people's access, the way in which competition in the society is organized around jobs and housing and education, etc., then in fact the solutions to it have to take into account that real social relationship. I mean, when we say it's a social construction, I think it's really one of the problems with the way in which I think discourse theory, whatever we want to call it, approaches the idea of social construction is it reduces social construction of reality to language rather than to real relationships of power and equality and conflict.
I guess I would add to that in support of it. There have been a couple of moves on the part of people I think who would like to live in a society characterized by equality and access, but who are nervous about race consciousness. William Julius Wilson, for example, early on argued for universalistic approach dealing with these problems, only to find as he continued to study that race just won't go away. Mm-hmm. And it is lastingly important. There are two things, and I'll do the start with. The differences in access, the differences in practice and treatment are sustained. There's no question but what every kind of informal and formal observation of the lives of black young people, all kinds of people, reveals that they are treated differently, and that has some real impact. Either race is important, and you address it as race, or the only other conclusion that a lot of people seem happy to leap to is those differences are related not to race, but to ability. And I reject that. Mm-hmm. It seems clear to me that the kinds of universalistic approaches, although I understand the motivation, still leaves racial effects starkly in our faces, and there's no way around it. I wish that weren't so, but it is. And I don't see how you address racist practice that has racial consequences without doing it on the basis of race. I don't understand how you do it.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think that that whole discourse of sort of the idea that we could think in a different way, if we could think in terms of, you know, not in terms of categories and more in terms of colorblindness, I think has a political component to it, and that it, like, I don't think it can be neglected that that discourse feeds into the same political discourse and the same political moves that are being made to create those categories and to solidify, you know, racist hierarchies. So, in other words, I think that the perspective should be more based on concrete political actions to do something about the problem as opposed to thinking about it, because those ideas just sort of, I mean, make us think that the problem's just gonna go away when it won't, unless something's done.
Well, isn't that what happened in California? So you were saying, you know, the moment that we say it's no longer about race, just move on and open up and have these standards, that the law school ended up with two people. And that's the direct effect of neutralizing that argument. It's very dangerous, I think. I see the or understand a little bit of the academic discourse on it. I haven't been able to see the translation from a very interesting academic argument to a socially conscious action there has been no connection between the two that I have heard of.
I recently heard Eduardo Bonilla Silva speak, who's written several interesting books about race, and he was, I think, talking about the effort to to move to a more colorblind way of looking at things, and he was very funny. He came out and he said, it's so interesting. There's no races. I don't know any racists anymore. Everybody says they're not racist. And all these racist things keep happening, but I don't know.
I guess I'd rather just ask you more questions, but I'm going to put my two cents in.
Okay.
It just seems, though, that this notion of it's not as simple a dichotomy as color blindness versus race consciousness, right? I mean, for example, Lonnie Gwynne Miner's Canary actually offers, if you will, a way to circumvent this dichotomy by suggesting that we look at the kinds of practices and the kinds of inequities which emerge when comparing different groups, and we think about using those as ways to create new modes of interaction, new pedagogies. And so one of her favorite examples is, to say, why is it that black students will speak less in a classroom? But they will offer answers, like they will do worse on various scores or tests and things like that. And she says, what she noticed was that black students more often tend to work well together and actually, will find different approaches to problem solving. And she says, then why not take this site as a way of reincorporating a new pedagogy, which does, is a very interesting, recommending race conscious versus race neutral approaches to the problem of racist education. So I don't think it's as simple as, race consciousness doesn't translate, or race color blindness doesn't translate into practical policy. There's actually a lot of different approaches there that are quite imaginative and very complicated.
Uh-huh. Well, and how would that lead to actually getting minorities into institutions of higher education?
One way might be to think about different criteria such as accounting for perseverance as, in fact, a quality, as a trait that we're looking for, in secondary institutions, and actually saying, let's look at the kinds of scores that minorities are receiving on SATs and accounting for the fact that they're achieving these scores under extremely adverse conditions and trying to, in some sense, control for perseverance or control fortitude or patience or something like that. But these are the kinds of qualities that may not necessarily accurately correlate to quantitative test scores, but we can, in fact, find ways to infer these.
That's true, although in order to infer that, you would have to know that it was a black student, right? And for instance, right now, there's a bill that's going to be voted on in California in 2 years, a racial privacy initiative, I think it's called, which would make it illegal for any state institution to ask for racial data. So that would mean that no admissions officer could know, legally, would be forbidden to know the race of an applicant.
Sure. No, I'm not necessarily suggesting that we have to go in a color-neutral direction. What I'm suggesting is that there's a variety of mm-hmm. ways to think about race, which go beyond, we're either aware of it or not. I mean, there are ways, for example, to go to a secondary tertiary level of thinking about the implications of race
uh-huh.
that get us beyond this kind of simplistic dichotomy. That was my only
thought. Well, I kind of have an idea for race, standards here. Obviously, before accepting that race is important, you need some criteria, and you've been giving those arguments, and those criteria are all about class. It's about in order to say a race is important, we're saying, this is why people of color are economically and socially oppressed. Why can't those just be the criteria?
Socioeconomic factors?
Yeah.
Well, because working class whites don't suffer the same discrimination that working class blacks do.
But the way you define the discrimination, if I remember correctly, is that the kind of communities that they come from,
and the kind of
those are also defined socioeconomically, aren't they?
Well, as I was saying, most working whites go to schools and live in neighborhoods which are more mixed. They're not as segregated by class as most black people are.
Why can't school.
I mean, socioeconomic status is a criteria in most schools. So that does mean that poor white people get a certain, you know, that's a consideration that should work to their advantage. That they, if they've overcome the goals of having fewer opportunities, you know, that they should be given some consideration for that. Most schools already do that. But what I'm saying is, I'm arguing that there's something in it, something separate. It does overlap, but it is separate. That racial factors are distinct and separate from socioeconomic factors, even though they frequently coincide. I believe that's true.
I don't know if this is directly related to what you are saying, but I think that part of it is not just the environment in which you grow and access or not, but how you're viewed and how you're perceived. You know, I remember when I first moved, I'm from Puerto Rico, I moved to the States and suddenly I became a woman of color overnight. I had to learn a new identity that was imposed. It didn't matter that my father is a doctor, that I grew up in a high middle class environment, that I have every privilege that I, you know, could have, that I have fair skin or light skin or whatever it is that they call that here. I came from a completely different environment. I was locked into one category when I came here. And after being an honor student my whole life, I almost flunked my first year in graduate school. I felt certainly a lesser being. I felt, you know, people were nervous when I was trying to speak. And that was an external factor. I grew up with access to things that most people don't. And I still experience the exact same thing that Latinos experience in the United States. It was imposed in my life that I had to be that.
Yeah. I mean, even for myself, moving from Northern Virginia, there was this one world that we saw that, you know, is very high middle class, upper class, and, you know, never even felt, never asked how white, because everyone in the class was a different race, a different place, a different area, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not until I actually moved to Baltimore did I actually feel, whoa, I'm in a predominantly black area, and they do label you as either being black or white. I mean, matter of fact, when I first came to Baltimore, the first thing that one of the black kids told me was that I speak white, I act white. Mm. So it was more of not even, instead of being labeled black, but I'm not white, yet, you know, I'm black. I mean, it was a totally different experience.
I'm wondering like how affirmative action would help that. So.
Well, it would help equalize opportunity. Mm-hmm. It means that if you went to a school where you didn't have AP classes and you didn't have a science lab and you didn't have extracurricular activities and all those kinds of things, you still have a chance at getting into a decent college and, you know, improving your life through your own initiative that way. Whereas without affirmative action, you probably wouldn't be able to get into a college. That's basically the difference in things.
I have kind of a technical question. In the Brown case, from what I understand, a big ruling factor in that was like psychological ramifications of black children being felt as lower, and like children doing drawings and like drawing themselves as smaller compared to like white teachers or other white students, and just like that, like oppression being like becoming part of a community's idea about themselves. And I was wondering if any of those kinds of arguments are being argued in more recent cases today about self-identity and about how lack of representation is self-identity in groups.
Well, in the University of Michigan case, some of the students' testimony, I think, did address that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for instance, Crystal James talking about what happened to her sense of self,
right,
being in an underrepresented minority.
Mm-hmm.
Are
any of these going to be held in the Supreme Court? What's the third party and what is the...
These were student interveners, so they're all from the third party.
Right.
The Supreme Court justices have been given all of these transcripts and presumably will be familiar with them. I mean, that's you know, technically what they're responsible for, because it's all part of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, as in terms of the case transcripts, it's just many volumes, and like volumes 1 through 8 are University of Michigan, and 8 through 15 are the interveners. Actually, the interveners actually took about twice as much of the court time as the University of Michigan, interestingly, although they're not getting to present to the Supreme Court. But so hopefully that you know, the transcribed information is there. Yeah, I mean, I think what you're describing is one of the reasons it was important to have students there and their voice present. Yeah.
Also, kind of like the gentleman was asking about the affirmative action. I can tell you in Maryland, in Baltimore, the 27 high schools, 4 of the top schools in Baltimore, Poly City, Western, and
Eastern.
No, they're actually 9 more.
Oh.
School for the Arts, I think. Eastern connected to Lake Tustin, long story.
Okay.
But now they just actually instituted a program where I think they choose one student from 4 schools in Baltimore. I think out of those 4 schools, if out of all of them, they get a free ride to the University of Maryland. The other 22 or whatever schools, compared to my high school and the other 3, basically are the worst schools in terms of conditions, students who are accepted, overcrowdedness, funding, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I can go down the line. My school was supported technically by several of our alums, not the city technically. I mean, and in terms of that, the education was extremely different. We had AP courses, International Baccalaureate. We competed with private schools, other schools out of the state. They competed with city students and only other students in the city area. So for them to get a ticket to Baltimore out of whatever their neighborhood was and out of the life that they lived, that was more than what they could ever dream of. And I actually have friends who were fun to leave. And the best experience for them. And it's different for every person in any major city area compared to a student who, for example, is in Baltimore County, who, despite them being in a very poor area, yet their high school was mixed, as she said. You can go to school in Towson and be with the top rich people, with some of the low level, if not poor students, and in the same school, which will actually have the same opportunities, unlike the Baltimore City, where you would not have those opportunities to continue to slash educational opportunities. And where unless you get a free ticket through a scholarship program to attend a private school, or you're going to attend one of the other top-notch public schools, which is get a test to get into, you basically are either stuck there, or you must find other ways to truly get yourself out of there, which has been sadly a sad truth about the city urban schools.
I mean, I think just one following up on this, I think you were pointing this out in your comments about affirmative action addresses the problem of equality of opportunity, of trying to overcome past injustices so that people compete as equals for the shrinking number of decent jobs, decent places in school, decent housing, etc. It doesn't affect at all equality of outcome. And I think that part of it, I think that some people, I think maybe what you're trying to get at is that it doesn't address the fact that there's inadequate funding for public education at any level, that there's inadequate, decent, affordable housing for everyone, that there's an inadequate number of decent jobs that are meaningful, secure, decently well-paying, etc. Affirmative action needs to be defended just on the principle that in this society at this point, people should be able to at least compete as equals. But we ought to recognize that it doesn't address the equality of outcome. And it was never meant to, and that's why it was, in fact, a response to a movement that was demanding greater equality of outcome. It was initially a very conservative response to those demands, but we still have to defend it in terms of people should be able to compete as equals.
I agree with that, and I'd also like to add just that I think that the very fact that it's been rolled back over the last, you know, 50 years or so, gives evidence that, you know, it's part of a broader system of racial oppression, and that, you know, just as it's an attempt to, you know, make up for past injustice, it's also an attempt to make up for, you know, a greater, you know, the society that we live in, and the fact that, you know, it may do something about, you know, taking kids out of inner city schools and putting them into colleges. We still have an inner city that's predominantly, you know, black. And
I just want to add to what you're saying that I think that's precisely why it's important that this has generated the beginning of the new civil rights movement, because because that movement needs to fight for integration in K through 12, needs to fight for equal opportunity in every area and every level of life, not just at college, but they just kind of focused on this as a topic.
Yes. A lot of people have left, and we've been talking to people out in the hallway. A student from UMass Amherst, one of the benefits of having you come in and speak has been to help us organize to actually get students from New England to DC. I think there's been a lot of organizing on the West Coast and the Midwest, as you mentioned, and a real lack of it in New England. And we're trying to counteract that as much as possible. So we've got a bus going from UMass Amherst, and we're also urging people to carpool if they can. And Carmel and I have sign-up sheets if any students or anybody here wants to get on the bus. It's a free bus. We've got funding from the UAW, and we're going to be able to provide $10 stipends to people to ride the Metro, as well as we're trying to, you know, get some food donations and things like that. So it's as accessible as it can be, and if you can spread the word about it, that would be great.
And that's Tuesday, very early in the morning, right?
Yeah,
we're leaving
late
Monday
at
night.
We're leaving at 11, well, organizing at 11, leaving at 11 on Monday night, and trying to arrive by 8 a.m., and then leaving D.C. at 5, be back by midnight.
The demonstration starts at 9 a.m. because that's when the justices arrive. Do you want to give any contact information?
Yeah, honestly, I think if people are even thinking about it, they should just sign up with their phone number, because what we're doing at this point is just by phone. You can cancel, but the sooner we can get all the numbers and names down, the better. I do have a leaflet that does information at the bottom, both email and the phone number. So I can just pass that around.
Okay.
We also printed up the itinerary for anyone that does want to drive on their own that includes, where to go and when, and stuff. So I'll just pass
the
snack around and people can take what they're
interested in. Thank you. I know you talked a lot about people of color. Can you send it to mostly predominant white schools? There was actually one case in Alabama, I think it was Alabama State University, with predominant blackness, where it's been counterproductive, where that affirmative action case, the NAACs have to integrate with more students, white students in Alabama. And a lot of black students don't like this idea. Accepting students, as they say, who are less qualified, but also to meet this quota that, you know, that has been instituted in, for affirmative action. So the cases are going back both ways. And even though we only hear about, you know, Michigan and probably UC and California, and the issues both ways.
Right. Well, a lot of the people who are working to defend affirmative action also defend historically black, you know, universities. And colleges, because basically saying that both of these are remedies to prior discrimination,
right,
and that people need to find a way to get educated in whatever works best for them. So, well,
it's,
thank you very much.
Right, it's 5 o'clock. Thank you, Teresa.